You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Chairman Mao, Jamie Howe, Ho Chi Minh, Asif Din, Václav Havel, Graham Savile, No Surrender, Percy Fender, Guerrilla Cricket.
Welcome to Guerrilla Cricket. December the 3rd sees the release of Inside the Tour, the Ashes 86-87. It's the definitive story of that extraordinary tour told by Mark Pugach by those who were part of it. It's a terrific listen. And you'll find it via your usual podcast provider. One of those who was not just there, but became man of the series is my guest on Guerrilla Cricket today, Chris Broad. Chris, welcome to Guerrilla Cricket.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Well, six test hundreds in your career, I counted. Four of them were against Australia. Was there consciously something special for you every time the Ashes rolled around?
I would like to say yes, but unfortunately, I played against Australia in England and didn't do quite as well as I had in Australia. I think the pitches in Australia suited me better than the pitches here in the UK. And basically, I had a purple moment, and for that 18-month period, you know, I very rarely failed in pitches in Australia, and it was just a magic moment.
Well, some purple moment. Well, before we go on to that series, remarkable as it certainly is, I wanted to just take you back to your debut, actually, because that was at Lord's against the West Indies. You got yourself a 50. Now, that series, as we know, went horribly badly, really, for England. But you were facing Malcolm Marshall, Joel Garner, Michael Holding, admittedly in a losing cause. You made yourself a 50 on debut. Didn't you feel after that series, crikey, things can only get better from here, having faced that sort of attack?
You know, I was so delighted to receive a call up to play, because I think it's every English cricketer's dream to play for their country. And I was very fortunate, having moved from Gloucestershire to Nottinghamshire, that season in 84, and so quickly been given a call up to play for England. I was just enjoying the moment. And sure, at the end of the season, when I wasn't selected to go on the tour of India, it was very disappointing. But we were, cast your memory back to those days where we were very much in a horses for courses type selection policy. And my forte was, allegedly, was against fast bowling. So to play against the West Indies was a forte of mine. And I think the selectors also had a view that the West Indies bowlers didn't bowl particularly well to left-handed batsmen. I'm not sure that was proven in that series.
Well,
but
no.
You know, I was just delighted to have played and very disappointed at the end of the season when I wasn't given a chance to go on tour.
But well, maybe that disappointment fueled what was to come. So let me just remind people about the 86-87 tour. Obviously, England won against the odds, 2-1. You saw England over the line to win the first test in Brisbane after a few wobbles. wobbles
well,
around
yeah,
you.
There were some of mine as well, yes. Right. First innings.
Yeah, well, true. You then went on to become only the third Englishman after Jack Hobbs and Wally Hammond to score three consecutive Ashes test hundreds. You got the 162 at the Wacker in a drawn game, 116 at Adelaide, and then crucially 112 at the MCG for England to win by an innings. I guess one question is, it amongst all of that fantastic purple spell for you, do any of those stick out more than others?
Yes. The 100 at Perth, your first 100 is always a very memorable moment. And my parents were in the crowd during that test match. So the fact that we won the toss and batted on an absolute road and an outfield that was like glass was just an absolute delight. And yes, I mean, it's very sad, I suppose, in some aspects that test cricket or a top level test cricket will no longer be played at the Wacker, but it has a very special place in my heart.
People might be glad of a bit more shade, but other than that, I agree. Those playing, I agree with you. And you mentioned your parents, which I recall you'd said before, and I can only imagine how that must have felt for you and indeed for them. Well, now, nobody gave England much of a chance, did they? And yet England prevailed, and you magnificently so. Was there any moment during the series when you suddenly thought things have clicked here, that we are gonna do this?
Yeah, when we went 2-0 up at Melbourne with only one to play.
Okay. There are no triggers, though, sort of.
I mean, there wasn't the media coverage then that there is now. So the build-up to it was an England-Australia clash, not the Ashes, although it was the Ashes. The media hype about England-Australia clashes now is enormous. Mm. So, and it was my first tour, and it was a tour to Australia, a country that I'd been to before and played some club cricket. So I was looking forward to it. And where I said that it was every cricketer's dream to play for England, it was certainly every international cricketer's dream to, English cricketer's dream to play in Australia. And of course, to win in Australia would have been the cherry on top. And so it proved.
Very, very much so. Well, there was, of course, that famous quote. This must have followed you around. Of course, you've got the perfect riposte to it. But the late Martin Johnson, who'd written, of course, that, I mean, it wasn't a great warm-up for England. You know, you'd lost a couple of series. Australia hadn't won a series in seven, I think, since 84. It was remarkable. So they were struggling. You described them, I think, as emerging rather than a poor team, which I thought was good, was kind of you. But Martin Johnson famously said, you know, the famous quote, can't bat, can't bowl, can't field. Did that poke a bit of a fire amongst the players on the tour?
Do you know, I think we took an enormous lead from the senior players of the tour. Martin Johnson was probably right because, you know, we didn't score very many runs. We didn't look like a team that was going to be able to bowl out an international side. And some of our fielding was pretty average. But the first month of the tour, for me, was desperately trying to find some form. But for the other guys, was just acclimatizing to a country that they already knew. And I will always remember Ian Botham standing up at our pre-test match dinner and giving us a right rollicking and saying, you know, what's happened in the last month has now happened. This is where the tour starts. And of course, he went out and he got 100. Gower got some runs. Lamb got some runs. You know, the senior players came to the party.
Well, I'm very glad you asked that. You know, you mentioned that because I had a very specific question about that. I've read that.
Away.
Well, I've read the quote from Ian Botham several times. It's something along the lines of what gets printed was, that's it, the party's over, the game begins tomorrow. And I've listened to the podcast on which you appear, which is, as we've said, fantastic listening. Everybody remembers what he said differently, including they all get the gist of it. They all say the effect it had on them. What was actually said, you are from Gladstone, Mike Gatting, they all remember something slightly different. What's your actual memory of what he said?
You know, I mean, I can picture the meal. I can picture sitting in the room and the cold, hard facts of the actual speech have passed me by now. But I do remember, in all seriousness, that here was this, you know, legend of the game and our lead player, if you like, standing up and using an awful lot of expletives to the rest of his team to say, this is where the tour starts. The exact words I can't recall.
Possibly the expletive, that's why people remember it differently.
Possibly.
I'm guessing.
But for me, this was a man who had been to Australia a number of times, wanted to succeed in the country, and he was obviously from 1981, had a great record against Australia, but not necessarily in Australia. And I think he really wanted this team to gel together, as we had begun to do in the month leading up to it, but mostly off the field rather than on the field. And he wanted us to take the off-field gelling to the on-field part, and he was going to lead the front. And certainly by his actions on the field, he definitely led from the front in that first test match. And the first test in any series is massively crucial because Australia had just drawn a test series in India, so they were the favourites going into this test series. And we needed to come out fighting.
Well, you certainly did that in Brisbane. You'd actually, there was a quote I read from you a while back about, you know, a lot of the acclimatizing was about wine and social more than the cricket at one point, which makes me want to kind of ask you, because there was so much going on around this tour. I mean, this is why the podcast is such fun, because you get a little bit of the sense of that. I mean, but you had, you know, even from the build-up and the poor form of both teams, you had the Gower Gatting I'm in charge handover, you had the return of Ian Botham after a brief sojourn away from the game, you had parting wine, rum, fancy dress, Francis Edmonds following the tour, and Elton John was your team DJ, I think, after Melbourne, and your cheerleader in chief. I mean, there's so much going on. How, as a comparative new boy, but with so much responsibility of opening innings, how did you keep your own focus with everything there going on around you?
Partly because I wasn't totally involved in the party side of it. I was, and throughout my, you know, I've got a great friend, Phil Bainbridge, who, you know, he enjoyed the social side of cricket and I enjoyed drink, but, you know, my focus was mainly on the playing side of it. Phil had massive, massive more talent than I did, but I was boring, if you like, and I enjoyed playing cricket and I couldn't play with, you know, any sort of ailment. So I needed to focus on the job in hand. And obviously the disappointment of 84, of missing out on a tour, I was desperate to do as well as I possibly could. And so my focus wasn't necessarily on a lot of late nights and drinking and socialising. It was doing what I needed to do and going out on the field of play and scoring runs. And so I think that was my focus. And it just, yes, of course, you know, there were times when we would have a drink together and socialise and enjoy the tour, enjoy Australia as it was as a whole. But, you know, for me, it was about doing enough socialising until that was it, and you move on to the next day's play and being able to do that.
Well, something else I'd read in the past that you described Mike Gatting as your sort of captain, get up and go, loved a challenge. tell me a little bit, perhaps, about how he helped you as captain, because ultimately the team did focus. They knuckled down. They listened to Saria, who wasn't Saria, I don't think, at the time. And you got that magnificent result, and you piled on runs, and you did it. Tell me a little bit about how personally Mike Gatting helped steer you along.
Well, I mean, cricket is a very funny sport in that the captain has a massive influence over how the team gels together and plays. And, you know, in my career at county level and at international level, you know, there are various captains who you look at and who I look up to and respect. And obviously, you know, Mike had a great deal of respect from a number of people within the team. Yes, there have been captaincy changes at international level on a fairly frequent basis. But for me, he was a Joe Soap type character and a Mr. Average type character. He wasn't a highly educated individual who mixed with the hoi polloi. He was everyday sort of individual who I could relate to. And for me, as an ordinary player in the team, you know, he would just give me some advice, words of advice, and send me out on the field of play. And I got the impression, understood who I was. So for me, that was a terrific thing.
Well, I can imagine as a, you know, comparative. I mean, you'd gone through, you know, it was Sri Lanka and obviously the West Indies series. As a comparative newish member of the team, that was worth its weight in gold for you. So man of the series, those three fantastic back-to-back tons. You got that award. How much did that really mean? How much does it still mean when you think back on that?
Well, you know, having played for Notts and the previous season, Richard Hadley had won the International Cricketer of the Year. Mm. It was quite a feather in my cap. Not that I'm comparing myself to Richard in any way, shape or form, because for me, he was one of the best all-rounders in world cricket and will always go down as one of my all-time heroes with tremendous talent. You know, I didn't have anywhere near the sort of abilities that he had, but to be able to walk into the dressing room the following summer and say, "Oh, International Cricketer of the Year, yes, Richard, yes, it's easy, isn't it?"
well, it was all
a bit of fun.
Well, it's a bit of fun you will keep with you forever, that's for sure.
Absolutely, yeah.
So after seven tests, you know, home tests and away, you carried on making runs. You went on and made another ton against Australia, didn't you, in the 1988 bicentenary test.
Yes.
Did that have the same buzz?
Yes, very much good. So. Back at a venue that I knew with pretty much the same sort of team against pretty much the same sort of opposition. And yes, it was, took me back 8 months to the previous Ashes. And this was a place that I felt comfortable playing cricket in. And right from the word go, found the middle of the bat and was enjoying myself.
So when the England phase of your career kind of came to an end, did you feel that there were international runs left unscored and that England were missing out when that happened? I think a lot of people I think a lot of people did think that.
Well, I think any sportsman can look back at certain times of their careers and think you've left something out there. Mm. I did, although I looked at my abilities and a number of people questioned whether I had the ability to score runs at this level. I had a limited technique. Most of my runs were scored between mid-off and square leg. I had a bum that stuck out. Most people were mentioned that I had an unusual stance. You know, I wasn't a David Gower. I wasn't a classical left-hander, a cricket player, but I had a great mental fortitude, and I believed in being out there and trying as hard as I could to score as many runs as I could. And, you know, Australia on those pitches against that bowling attack suited me at the time. And, I loved every moment of it.
Well, and people love watching it. Certainly English people. I'm not sure about Australians, but English people certainly love watching it. It just brings me on to a couple more sort of questions. And, you had a couple of fiery moments in your career. Did those experiences help to inform your current approach in terms of understanding, particularly when you have to deal with tricky situations and fiery characters? Does it inform you to be better at what you do now?
I'd like to hope so. I mean, I'm passionate about this sport. I think this sport is an amazing sport. It's given me an amazing career, an amazing life, and is still giving me an amazing career and life. And I am very passionate about how the game is played. And you know, there are times when I don't do as well as I could, and I see players not doing as well as they could. And that gives me an understanding of the pressures that these players are under out in the middle, and an empathy towards them achieving a level that they should do, so that the next generation coming into the game are aware of where the standards lie.
Well, that's a great appraisal. I mean, let's just look ahead very briefly to the series coming up, although it's seeming to be curiously English in terms of its weather, which might work in England's favour. Yeah. I mean, one thing that, England have been working for a while on building up a pace attack, which has sort of fallen apart a bit, and you're back to great experience. But you are, how much are a role of a role model is that 86 and 87 team? I mean, you had Gladstone, Ian Botham, De Freitas, you had two spinners. You didn't have, you had Graham Dilley, of course, but you didn't have, relentless pace. And yet you more than did the job. It's a little similarity there with perhaps this England team. What can they learn from you, and how will it serve them if they do?
Well, I mean, I think I know the England team have Troy Cooley in their camp this Ashes series, which is going to be a massive boost to them. And you look at the greatest Australian fast bowler of recent time, Glenn McGrath. He wasn't anything out of the ordinary. He was someone who hit a line and length, and the Kookaburra ball doesn't do a huge amount off the seam, but will do enough so that if the likes of Ollie Robinson and Stewart and Jimmy, if there is moisture around, can hit the lines and lengths that are required, then there's no reason why they can't knock over on paper a very strong Australian batting lineup.
Well, no one's done it at Brisbane since you did.
Well, that's right. Consequently, there is a potential for England to back up someone like Joe Root in the side that they've picked. Most people are looking at it and going, the Australian bowling attack is probably too strong for the top six. But, with the likes of Bill Athey and myself and James Whittaker came in and got some runs, there is opportunity for those lesser lights, if I can call them that, to stake their claim and get themselves into the Ashes lineup and do a good job for the side.
There's also a big, high-profile, charismatic all-rounder. There's a similarity as well, possibly, but providing he's fit and raring to go between the
a boost for the England, and that's a boost for the England team as a whole, certainly with having Ben Stokes back. Yes,
isn't it just okay? So I'm conscious of time now. Last question for you. I don't know if it's like the Masters where you hand over something, but you were man of the series. Who's your tip for man of the series this time around?
Well, I'd like to say a certain Stuart Broad.
Yep.
But I don't know. I think it's there for anyone to put their hand up and grab, really, someone who is going to go and score a huge amount of runs, or someone who's going to take an enormous amount of wickets. It's very difficult on both sides to be able to pick out one individual who is going to be the star. But, you know, maybe the fact that Ben Stokes has had a layoff and will be raring to go and is a proven quality batsman and bowler and fielder, of course, you know, he would possibly be my tip, but I don't want to put in any additional pressure on him for that recognition.
I think we all feel that way a wee bit. Well, a reminder to everybody that you can hear the story of the memorable 86-87 Ashes with Chris, plus Siri and Botham, Mike Gatting, David Gower, Alan Lamb, Glaston Small, Phil De Freitas, Mickey Stewart, not to mention Jeff Lawson and Alan Board, on the Inside the Tour podcast series. Chris Broad, it has been a real pleasure chatting to you on Guerrilla Cricket. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Guerrilla Cricket.
Revolutionary cricket commentary.
Sports Social Podcast Network.